Today is Monday, December 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, a volcano in New Zealand erupted today, killing five people and leaving many missing.
For those who have loved ones on or around the island at the time, and I can assure them police are doing everything they can.
The House Judiciary Committee is meeting today as it continues to move forward on drafting articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump. And documents show U.S. officials misled the public about the 18-year war in Afghanistan. Those stories and more coming up next. At least five people are now confirmed to have died after a volcano erupted off the east coast of New Zealand's Northern Island. Police confirmed on Monday. Reuters' Ryan Brooks has more.
New Zealand scrambled to save people caught in a deadly volcano eruption on Monday. One tourist posted video of his escape by boat sailing past a massive cloud of ash. Several people were injured while others have been reported missing in the eruption. Rescuers were racing to save those caught up in the event. At emergency sites on the mainland, people were wheeled off on stretchers. Officials have confirmed many were tourists visiting White Island. The volcano there is one of New Zealand's most active. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern voiced sympathy for the victims.
We know that there were a number of tourists on or around the island at the time, both New Zealanders and visitors from overseas. I know there will be a huge amount of concern and anxiety for those who have loved ones on or around the island at the time. And I can assure them police are doing everything they can.
An official from Royal Caribbean Cruises confirmed passengers from the Ovation of the Seas cruise ship were touring the island on Monday. When its volcano erupted, experts say it threw an ash plume 12,000 feet into the sky. However, the country's geological agency called the eruption short-lived and said there were no signs of an escalation.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. Democratic and Republican lawmakers are convening in the House Judiciary Chamber as they move towards possible vote this week on articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump. House Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler outlined what he thought was at stake during his opening statement.
If the president puts himself before the country, he violates a president's most basic responsibility. He breaks his oath to the American people. If he puts himself before the country in a manner that threatens our democracy, then our oath, our promise to the American people, requires us to come to the defense of the nation.
Republican ranking member Doug Collins defended the president, saying that the president did nothing wrong.
Where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here? I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment. Because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do, except that interfere and basically make sure that they believe the president can't win next year if he's impeached.
Now joining us on the phone to explain the process and what's taking place in the committee chambers is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So, Catherine, can you kind of walk us through what we're seeing today play out on television in the United States and around the world as both the counsel for the Republicans and Democrat present evidence in the hearing?
Right. So, unbelievably, today is actually the first day that we're hearing the entire case against President Donald Trump laid out. We had all of those House Intelligence Committee hearings where we heard from individual witnesses. And of course, last week when the impeachment inquiry moved into House Judiciary Committee, we heard from constitutional law scholars who were talking about whether the president's offenses met the standard for impeachment. But today, what we're hearing from both sides is the case for and against Donald Trump. We're hearing something of a narrative from the Democratic Council explaining this whole complex saga from beginning to end, and then hearing the Republican rebuttal.
Now, this is a hearing that is actually quite, you know, energetic. There's a lot going on. There was a disruption during Chairman Nadler's opening statement, right?
Right. We barely got, I think we maybe got a minute into the hearing before we had a disruption. There was a protester who is reportedly from InfoWars, which is a website, who was saying, yelling in the chamber that President Donald Trump is innocent and the Democrats are the guilty ones. And then, of course, we've had a lot of back and forth between Democratic and Republican members of Congress who are kind of tussling over the process of all of this. Republicans are reiterating their argument that none of this process has been fair to President Donald Trump, and they're trying to slow down this hearing by using procedural points to get the hearing all bogged down.
Right, and as we're going to air, the counsels haven't even completed their opening statements yet, and there's another round of questioning that's still on the docket to take place later this afternoon.
Right. So we are reaching our third hour of this hearing as you and I are talking. We are still making our way through the opening statements. And then, of course, House Judiciary has a large membership. We have 40 Democratic and Republican members of Congress who each get their 5 minutes of questioning of these witnesses. It's going to be a marathon hearing today as they lay out the case for impeachment.
So that's what's taking place right now. There's been a lot of speculation that, you know, at last week, Speaker Pelosi tasked Jerry Nadler, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, to draft articles of impeachment. And there's been a lot of speculation that there could be a vote this week about, you know, formalizing that process. What are you hearing in the halls of Congress?
So what will most likely happen this week is that the House Judiciary Committee will reveal those articles of impeachment. We know that they worked feverishly over the weekend, beginning to block those out. And that's when we'll first hear the specific charges that Democrats are lodging against President Trump. Abuse of power will almost certainly be in there, likely bribery, and possibly even a charge related to obstruction of justice with the Mueller report. So once they release those articles of impeachment, then the debate will reach a whole new level, and we will probably get a vote scheduled sometime in the next week. Because, of course, remember, Democrats and Republicans only have 9 days left in session in this year before they're supposed to go on a Christmas and New Year's break. They also have to pass government funding by December 20th, or the entire U.S. government shuts down.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
The Washington Post newspaper has published a trove of government documents that reveal senior U.S. officials misled the public about the 18-year war in Afghanistan by making overly optimistic pronouncements they knew were false and hiding evidence that the conflict had become unwinnable. The Post says the documents contain more than 400 interviews with senior military and government insiders who offered unrestrained criticism of what went wrong in Afghanistan and how the United States became mired in nearly 2 decade years of war. Joining us now on the phone is VOA's Carla Babb, who is our Pentagon correspondent. Carla, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Carla, what, in addition to what I just read, what are the important facts that we can glean from this massive trove of data that the Washington Post printed?
Well, this is really an interesting find, especially for reporters who have been asking the questions about the war and listening and hearing things from progress being made over and over again to it's a stalemate, but we should stay in there, to now we are seeing another side to the Afghanistan story, and that is that many officials have said that this isn't winnable and the U.S. did not have a plan. I was really struck by one of the three-star Army general who had said that the U.S. was basically devoid of any fundamental understanding on Afghanistan. The U.S. military did not know what it was doing, did not have the foggiest notion, he said, of what it was undertaking in Afghanistan. And this is just incredible after 18 years of war that none of this has been able to come out in this sophisticated manner. And we're talking about hundreds of interviews here. And this isn't just one person being upset. This is a consistent look at Afghanistan. And it basically was saying that the United States did not know what it was doing. And it has cost the U.S. over 2,000 U.S. service member lives and $1 trillion.
Has there been a formal Pentagon response to the printing in the Post?
There has not at this time. I know that myself and several of my colleagues have been pushing for a response. It's kind of hard to get a Pentagon response when a lot of these officials were actually Pentagon officials. You saw one of those was the Army general, the three-star Army general who basically served as the Afghan war czar under Presidents Bush and Obama. And then you have others, retired Navy SEALs are referenced in there. And then in addition to the people who were named, there were still plenty of others that were not named but were just given the title as government officials. So it's hard to get a Pentagon response where in one sense, this is the Pentagon's response of years and years of bent-up frustration on the war in Afghanistan.
Now, this is all coming at a time when the Trump administration has been trying to ink out a peace deal in Afghanistan with the Taliban, and those talks have largely stalled. Has there been any movement that you're aware of with, you know, getting a concrete deal in place?
Well, we know that the president had said that the Taliban is interested in making a deal, and that was one of the things that the Washington Post reporter who uncovered this information, that was one of his reasons why he wanted to get this story out when he did. He was actually still waiting on additional information and was suing for additional information, but he felt that with these new talks starting, that this information needed to get out to the public at this time. So we do not know at this point whether a deal is going to be made. There have been several discussions, several rumors about the U.S. reducing the number of troops in order for a ceasefire from the Taliban. None of this has been officially confirmed yet because there is no deal at this point that has been agreed upon by either side. But that is something that officials were looking forward to in the coming weeks.
Carlo Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Medical professionals have long recommended a healthy diet, exercise, and medications to patients who have high risk factors for maladies like heart disease, diabetes, or stroke. A new study from researchers at the University of California, San Diego, and the Salk Institute for Biological Studies provides evidence that a form of sporadic fasting called time-restricted eating helped improve the health of volunteer participants who had some or all of those risk factors. To follow a time-restricted eating program, you eat your entire daily intake of food over only a certain number of hours each day and fasting for the remainder of the day. The researchers found that when their study volunteers limited their eating to 10 hours or less each day over a 12-week period, they lost weight, reduced abdominal fat, lowered their blood pressure and cholesterol, and were able to maintain stable blood sugar and insulin levels. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A long-awaited summit in Paris today is aiming to find a way to end the war in Ukraine after 5 years and 14,000 lives lost in a conflict that has emboldened the Kremlin and reshaped European geopolitics. From Paris, we're joined by reporter Catherine Field with the latest. Catherine, how are you doing?
Hi, good. Thanks, Steve.
So we've had this day of meetings between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Mr. Putin. What can you tell us about what transpired today?
Well, so far, all I can tell you, Steve, is they are still talking. This got underway here in Paris around three and a half hours ago. So the fact that Vladimir Putin of Russia, Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine, and the intermediaries, the French President Emmanuel Macron, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, are still all in the room and are still talking is, as far as the French are concerned, good news, because you have to remember that these four have not gotten together since October 2016. This idea of this Normandy format, this idea where the French and the Germans would act as intermediaries and bring both sides together, that's back and they're talking together. So we're not really expecting any great announcement, but what they are hoping, Steve, is that this coming together now, the bilaterals, all of the four together as well, that there'll be some sort of consolidation, that everything will be, if you like, dialed back a bit, and that there will be some pathway forward. If not, the idea of bringing an end to this conflict isn't there yet, but somehow to kind of make inroads. So there'll be more dialogue and also the possibility of things like prisoner exchanges and perhaps even more possibilities for troops pulling back from the border.
Right. And you mentioned that Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, and Emmanuel Macron, the French president, were the ones kind of spearheading this. Did they give any kind of instance, press conferences, leading statements? You mentioned the exchange of prisoners and so forth, but anything that they were trying to do to really solidify those trust building measures that would dial back the tension?
The main issue that the French hope to come out of this, and it seems very small, but when you think of how long this conflict has been going on for, it is big. What the French president's office has said is they want some sort of disbanding of the illegal militias and the exit of foreign fighters from eastern Ukraine. What they really want, they want to see Ukraine taking back control of that border. At the moment, you have all sorts of foreign fighters on both sides, plus you have Russian soldiers, and they would like to see Ukraine being back in charge of its border. Big problem there, though, is, Steve, is that the Russians don't want that. They say they want to stay there until they're sure that what is happening on the ground reflects their needs. And what their needs are at this moment is they want to be sure that Ukraine is not integrated economically and militarily in the West. So it's a difficult call, that one, but if at least they can just get the illegal militias and the foreign fighters out of there, then perhaps there will be something that they can work on. Again, the fact that they are talking and that crockery hasn't been thrown around the room, people haven't walked out and gone home on planes earlier than scheduled, this is a good sign. And I think the other thing we've got to remember, though, Steve, is Germany and France are very keen that something comes out of this. They are very keen on having a normalization of relations with Russia. Let's just think back a few weeks ago. Emmanuel Macron was talking in an interview that he wanted a rapprochement with Russia. He was talking about how Russia cannot prosper in isolation. So he wants that. The Germans have been, if you like, less vocal, Steve, but they actually want more of a rapport with Russia. They want an end to sanctions. They've got a lot of economic interests in Russia. They want an end to that. And, of course, we've got that ever-present issue here in Europe of the gas pipeline. The Germans need Russian gas, and Ukraine has always been a country which those gas pipelines go through. So even though we're looking at Russia and Ukraine here, France and Germany are very keen to have all of the tensions dialed down and possibly having some of those sanctions eased.
Catherine Field reports out of Paris. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
The Russian flag and national anthem were banned from next year's Tokyo Olympics and other major sporting events for 4 years. Russia's hosting of world championships in Olympic sports also faced being stripped after the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, executive committee approved a full slate of recommended sanctions and punished the state authorities for tampering with a Moscow laboratory database. Craig Reedy, the organization's president, made this announcement.
The decision is designed to punish the guilty parties and send the message that it will not be tolerated. It stands strong against those who cheated the system while protecting those who did not.
Last month, WADA investigators and the International Olympic Committee said evidence shows that Russian authorities tampered with Moscow Lab's databases to hide hundreds of potential doping cases that falsely shift blame onto whistleblowers. Reedy added that athletes who can prove that they are not part of the conspiracy or committed wrongdoing would be allowed to participate. North Korea insulted U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday, calling him a heedless and erratic old man after he tweeted that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wouldn't want to abandon a special relationship between the two leaders and affected the American presidential election by resuming hostile acts. This comes after a test at the Sohae launch facility and North Korea's U.N. ambassador saying that all denuclearization talks were off the table. What does this all mean? For that, I turn to Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation.
Well, I guess I would have to say that my sense has been that denuclearization talks have been off the table since Singapore. Kim Jong-un has perceived that he didn't need to give up anything By my estimate, since he offered to denuclearize in March of last year, he's roughly doubled his nuclear destructive potential of his nuclear arsenal. He's not surrendered a single nuclear weapon to show good faith. He's not eliminated any production capability or even halted production. I think the denuclearization offer was a sham, that it was an attempt by Kim to buy time and to buy recognition, which he certainly got.
So what is the next avenue of opportunity to address North Korea's growing nuclear arsenal and growing missile capabilities?
Well, I think we have to recognize that Kim Jong-un has provided us the perfect context. He keeps insisting on corresponding measures. Well, in my mind, corresponding measures to doubling his nuclear destructive potential is increasing the sanctions. Now, it takes the UN, in most cases, to do anything serious there, but the thing we haven't done very seriously at this point is stop the ship-to-ship illicit transfers.
U.S. President Donald Trump signaled that military options have never really been off the table, but this is also coming at a time when cost-sharing and burden-sharing discussions are underway with South Korea, and the United States has put forward a reported ask of $5 billion that South Korea has essentially balked at. What kind of situation does that create in terms of a response either from the United States or South Korea should there be any more provocative actions?
Well, I think that while President Trump is asking for more money from the South Koreans, what he's really concerned about is the future. He's worried that great power conflict is potentially far more likely in the future, and none of us, neither South Korea nor the United States, have invested in producing military capabilities to adequately deter that threat. So I think what he's trying to do is to cause both of our countries to increase our capabilities. Now, he's asked for it as burden sharing, but it's not clear to me whether that's an absolute demand or whether that's a way of saying, look, we both need to be increasing our capabilities. You need to put more money into your capabilities. We need to put more in ours. Let's work out a deal for doing that.
Does the fact that this latest test was conducted at Sohae, which was partially dismantled as a good faith measure by North Korea, signal Pyongyang's willingness to take things in a new direction and a more forceful direction?
They've certainly threatened a new path, which is interpreted apparently as a more escalated approach against the United States. So sure, they're prepared to do that. But they're prepared to do that as long as the United States poses no retaliation or no escalation against them. I think that's the key, is we are not taking serious action to deter North Korea. Simply talking and saying military options are on the table is not adequate. That's not to say that we need to do a military strike on North Korea, like stopping ship-to-ship transfers. There are a wide variety of alternatives, especially information operations, that Kim is extraordinarily vulnerable to. We should be attempting to use information with the North, to use other forms of sanctions-related activity, and convince the North that if they want to play hardball, the U.S. can too, and they're not going to like the outcome. But it doesn't have to be an attack on North Korea. That would be a mistake, I think.
Bruce Bennett is a senior defense analyst with the RAND Corporation, speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, happy to do so.
A rainstorm paralyzed parts of Lebanon's capital of Beirut Monday, turning streets into small rivers, stranding motorists inside their vehicles and damaging homes in some areas. The flooding came as protesters have been holding nearly 2 months of demonstrations against the country's political elite and decades of widespread corruption and mismanagement. Protesters remain in their encampments in Beirut and other cities amid the heavy rain. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of producer Jackson Vunganyi, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of news and world events on our website. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.